This is a production of Cornell University.
All right. Welcome, everybody. It's PGA Championship Week. This is the week we were probably beginning to chat about Michael Black last year when he was at Oak Hill. In fact, I was at Craig Byrne Golf Club yesterday outside of East Aurora, New York. An absolutely beautiful track. I'll talk about that in a minute. But in it, you know, a lot of people were like, this time last year, we were excited about the PGA. And for those who don't know, I think Jeff Corcoran has moved on from that position. That's the superintendent at Oak Hill, and now has a consulting business with the superintendent at former superintendent Oakmont. So we're looking forward to some good golf. The drama ensues. You know, all they talk about is the baloney until the golf starts. And thankfully today they'll just start talking about the golf. But I know Carl's gotten something to say about this. I'm a sucker for a good dog picture, being a dog person myself. Whenever you can get the dogs to help out with enhancing your green speed or just the love they have of laying around the grass, always makes me happy to see it. And as I mentioned yesterday, I was with the Golf Course Superintendents Association of New York, Joe Lucas, the president was there, Rick Holforth, board member, Ron Stepanek, the executive director. Was a really well attended, maybe 17, 20 folks there, walking around a beautiful Robert Trent Jones Senior golf course, Carl. Really sort of very interesting and is about to go through some greens extension and a bunker redo. And much like we're doing, and he's one of the things that was really cool is he's got a POA nursery started, about half an acre of POA sod that he'll be producing that's needed for August of 25. I think one of the things that's interesting Terrence mentioned yesterday in the conversation was that, you know, they started planning for this last year, and it's been almost a two-year process to get a contractor and architect and people available to do the work. So Tyler Ray will be doing the renovation at Craig Byrne. I will say, Carl, real diamond in the rough. I actually didn't even know about this place until I got out there. And one of the topics that came up yesterday, which is really fascinating, and I know one that we've begun to discuss, he's got about 45 acres of high grass, fine fescue, monocultures. Essentially, he's been establishing monocultures out there for a number of years, and he'll be making a drone application of herbicides to that landscape. So Terrence really on the progressive edge of managing these things, because obviously you can't drive through them when you are, you know, growing them high the way they're trying to do. He only mows them once a year. And I know we've talked about managing the high grass this way at Bethpage. But Carl, since it's golf this week, you are our resident aficionado of these things. And of course, your name was brought up many times yesterday as the former champion, the Mid-Am champion. We were throwing that around yesterday among the crew. I don't think you played out it when it was at Craig Byrne that year. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about what's going to happen at Valhalla? I'm sure you've got something to say about this particular golf course.
Yeah, so, you know, every time there's a major championship, Frank, people talk about the golf course and they spend Monday through Wednesday talking about what's the golf course going to be like. And we mentioned architects already, and Robert Trent Jones Sr. was there at Craig Byrne, which there's a lot of players at Craig Byrne. They host a lot of New York State Golf Association championships. But there's a certain crowd of golf architecture folks who really like golden age architecture and firm and fast and really wide fairways. And they call that strategic architecture. So there's penal, that would be sort of an RTJ classification, heroic. And some could argue RTJ invented heroic golf course architecture, and then strategic. And people like Friday Golf, this is sort of the media outlet who talks about golf architecture, they like the strategic golden age architecture courses. Mm-hmm. So this week at Valhalla is not one of those. It's a Jack Nicklaus. And they had this tweet the other day that just sort of rubbed me the wrong way. They said it.
Oh,
Valhalla doesn't provide a thought-provoking test, nor does it take full advantage of its property. The design falls short. Ooh. And I wasn't able to read the article. It's behind a paywall. But you know, some of that stuff, Frank, and I get why people like certain, you know, designs more than others. But when you start saying golf doesn't provide a thought-provoking test, I'm thinking, man, golf is, there's a lot of thought that goes into golf. And I thought about this famous interview that Phil Mickelson does with David Faraday. And people will remember it. It's iconic because Phil's got all black on and he's got this leather black jacket. So he's a real sort of cool, slick back hair look. Faraday asks him, you know, what do you think about in a golf shot? And then Phil rattles off for 5 straight minutes uninterrupted every single thing he thinks about when he's about to hit a golf shot. He's talking about the temperature outside, the altitude you're playing at. What time of day is it? In the morning? Is it in the afternoon? The ball goes 4 5 yards shorter in the morning. Where's the wind? You know, what's the lie looking like? What height is the grass? Where's the grain of the grass facing? Distance, pin location, slope, geometry of the green, and where bunkers and water are. And so he's going on and on, and you're like, oh my God, this goes into every single shot you hit. And he's like, yeah, I have to process all these things. And when you list these things out, Frank, 8 of those 11 have nothing to do with the golf course architecture. And we think about thought-provoking. You could be in a flat field with a circular green, putting a 15 handicap on it. They got to still consider 8 of these 11 things when they're playing golf. I'm like, you know, we often, especially when we're talking about golf architecture, we're talking about challenging a player or making them think. And I'm just like, you know, golf is it's too hard, right? We're literally provoking golfers to the point where they're taking divots in Thad's greens out there in Terry Hills, or they're snapping clubs. I'm just sort of like, you know, the emphasis on how you play a golf course and how you score is, I guess, one thing you can analyze at a pro level for a PGA championship or something like that. But just for the everyday golf course, it'd be nice if we thought a little bit beyond, you know, what you're shooting on a golf course and some of the other benefits we get. Just as a recreational activity, right? The majority of golfers are out there just to have a good time for 4 hours. And I wrote about this. This is sort of a shameless plug for an article I wrote in the recent GCSANY newsletter. But I talk about, you know, there's all these other positive aspects to golf that have nothing to do with your score and things like physically walking around for 4 hours, how many calories you burn. If you do that routinely, you get these positive health outcomes over your lifespan, right? Social cohesion, learning how to be with strangers or your friends for 4 hours, talking to people. And then, you know, sort of the summary of the article is when we study urban green spaces and how parks makes us feel, when we can get out for a 10-minute or 15-minute walk in a park, we measures people, you know, their anxiety, their stress levels, and they always go down. That's a really good thing. Hey, 10 minutes, 15 minutes in green space is really good for your sort of mental well-being. So golf is the same thing. You get to do it for 4 hours. Surely, when people come off a golf course, they should be less stressed and have less anxiety. And it turns out that's not always the case. And a couple of the folks who study this, Parker Anderson has a thesis on this from his graduate work, is now they don't come off with less stress. And oftentimes they come out with more stress and anxiety. It's because they're focusing on their score and their performance. So just what I was wrapping this up today is, you know, it'd be nice if we could get our golfers to think a little bit more about sort of being out there in a natural environment, looking at things, taking in that beautiful landscape, the grass, the trees, the animals that are around. And as a superintendent or steward of the property, maybe you can sort of cue your golfers because they're going to forget. They're not going to think about those when they're left to their own devices, right? They're looking at the ground. Where's their ball going? If you have some signage or something, maybe you can say, hey, here's a cool vista. Look out at this, you know, mountain in the background. That's X mountain. Or hey, look at this tree. This is a unique tree in our region. Trying to cue golfers to, like, you know, this is a natural landscape, just like a lawn is, or a sports field, or a park, or a cemetery. Trying to get people to think a little bit more about just the golf score. So that's my rant
Yeah,
for my.
it's funny. Yeah, it's funny, Carl, because when I hear you talk, I remember the podcast I did with Parker Anderson, who did that study at Michigan, who said basically golfers barely know they're outside. They're so emphasized. I mean, when I read that thing that you sent over and like thought-provoking, you're exactly right. I'm overthinking a 3-foot gimme. I think I understand what they mean. And of course, you know, and I know. There's a whole culture of, I don't want to call them golf snobs, but it certainly is this sort of intellectual approach to looking at a golf course. And I, you know, I almost think you're exactly right. Usually the problem is we're overthinking it. But to your point, I think we feed this, right? Especially those in this business. I think golf superintendents, at rightfully so. I mean, I'm at Craig Burn. This is like the Hazeltine of Western New York. It's all scratch golfers. They play 10, 12,000 rounds a year. And, you know, it's all about the score and the betting and the this. And I'm not suggesting that any of those things happen, but we know they do. And I think the superintendent then gets sucked into, I got to produce the golf course, you know, for those people, because they barely, I got to remind them to look at the view, because they're not even going to look when they're playing. So I do think, you know, there's a part of the business that, you know, we respond to, but at the end of the day, Carl, they're the loudest voices, kid. They're the ones screaming, oh, the greens are slow. I mean, I'd love to see a superintendent, when somebody comes up, say, oh, you know, the greens, you know, don't feel so good today. I know, but isn't that view over the lake really beautiful? Says no golf superintendent. So right. I do think we have to have a balance for these things, but you're exactly right. The sort of public conversation that goes around golf sometimes, especially for architectural stuff, just completely eludes me. And I'm really glad for you as a really good golfer saying, hey, we should enjoy this being out there. And I know part of that's coming from you don't get out as much now being a parent. Yeah. Every time you're out there, being outside with the kid and the dog is good. And you're not as fussed about your score as you used to be, but you can remember the day when score was all that mattered.
Yeah. Yeah. It gave me a lot of stress and anxiety, but at the same time, now that I've learned, you know, and when I look at the data too, Frank, it's like, man, yeah, maybe I should just sort of enjoy being out there. And I bet people will have lower scores if they just sort of relax. Hey man, it's just
now, a 5 foot. It's not unheard of either, Carl, right? I mean, when I was at the US Open in 2018, going around Shinnecock, I was partnered with the superintendent at Sergio Garcia's golf course in Spain, right? Sergio Garcia, think of him what you want, but he's an enormously gifted, talented golfer. I mean, he maybe didn't win as much as everybody thought. The kid goes to the golf course for like a half an hour with his father, he gets a little waggle, hits a few balls, putts a few balls, and he's done. He's a feel guy, right, Carl? There's guys that want to grind. And then you also hear Scottie Scheffler. I used to go out for 2 hours after the round, and now I'm like, yeah, I'm all right. I can figure this out. I think even at the highest level, you hear this back and forth about managing the stress that you put on yourself to be exceptional at a game that you're going to shoot in. I mean, Tiger Woods shoots an 80 on a given day, right? And probably not even what some people would even think a very hard golf course. But yeah. But I do think there is something about golf course people and golfers that want to be challenged to the point of like, you got to put a sign up like you do at Bethpage. All right, let's get to some of the numbers. It was a generally cool week, right? I think many people would say we're still in a bit of a stall. I think grass is growing, but here's what I can tell you. As soon as the foot gets on the pedal for warmth and you keep getting these warm nights, grass, we're going to start hitting that surge of growth period we normally get in the springtime with many of our cool season grasses. It's been warming up rapidly. So if you're making your soil drench applications for Fairy Ring, you're late. For Summer Patch, you're probably right on time. Make sure you use the full rate and make sure you put it on with a lot of water. If it's going to rain, spray it in the rain. Absolutely, positively, the number one reason these things fail is they do not get deep enough in the soil profile. And if you're putting this thing on soils that water doesn't move through very well, put a wetting agent in with it to help it sort of penetrate and make its way down. And it still is going to be challenging. So, you know, Summer Patch is one of those diseases that we don't know we got a problem and until later in the season when the stress comes, and worse yet, the infection periods are longer and longer. And the stress is going deeper into the fall. Just as a reminder, Rich Buckley was diagnosing Summer Patch into October last year. So, you know, you want to get this early, but you also want to keep track of the stress levels that your plants are under, particularly from Summer Patch. I was out Western New York, and the first comment I made when we started was, wow, it's been a fairly uneventful spring, to which Terrence said, we got 7 inches of rain in the last couple of weeks. I'm like, oops, I guess I wasn't paying attention. But it has actually been, if you look at the map here, fairly wet in the last month in Western New York, even though I was thinking it's somewhat on the dry side. You're looking at 200% of normal from Erie, PA, all the way up into Rochester. And then at the other end of the spectrum in the New York metropolitan area, the last month is looking at 25 to 50%, 75% of normal. So there's a lot of dry areas. I, you know, for the two people that live in northern Maine, Carl, probably related to you somehow, it's very dry up there. And I will say south into Delmarva, the Delmarva Peninsula, I was down for the Virginia Tech graduation last week. Sorry to miss you all. And it's on the dry side down there. Now, it looks like we're going to have normal conditions. Looks like we're going to have pretty normal temperatures for the next 8 to 14 days. But I think what we're seeing of this sort of sporadic rainfall and just warm enough is, as we're going to talk about in a second, going to start to drive growth and going to start to drive diseases like dollar spot, which looks like it's starting to rear its head. So, Carl, I went to your growth potential thing, and I thought it was very interesting this past week. Bill Kreiser was taught, we were chatting with Bill, and Bill was talking about growth potential as really a measure of the way plants make sugars, right? Not really a measure of how they can grow, but how they can produce sugars. And he's played around with looking at the impact of temperature on growth. Like, you could have high growth potential, but not have enough moisture, right? And Carl, here's your model on a clay soil that demonstrated right when the rainfalls came through with no irrigation, you had growth in the plots last week or 2 weeks ago. And then it looked like it just sat there. And now it looks like moisture's coming again, temperatures are rising. And in a clay soil, we're going to get into moderate growth and probably heading towards the surge of growth. That same model corrected for a sandy, well-drained soil indicates you're not going to get that growth surge by any means. So what I think we've started to learn, and Carl, you know, I want to just take a minute here and have you chat about this. I know the springtime has not been your favorite time for this model, that we're not always getting the surge, but boy, this feels right now, based on what I'm seeing in dry areas. They're not growing as much. And I will also add, if you have areas where things are growing very well and you're getting a lot of traffic, traffic is a beautiful growth regulator. I saw a lot of heavily trafficked turf in the last few days that just simply wasn't growing as much as the turf right next to it. It looked perfectly fine. I mean, it was bluegrass, dense, and then next to it, it was about an inch and a half higher simply because people were walking there. And you know, other than compaction and traffic, not much is different. So talk a little bit, Carl, about the growth model in the spring and this sort of disparity that I'm showing here between the two soil types.
Yeah, so just a general structure of these models is essentially there's an optimal temperature that you'll put in. And the original paced turf growth model was saying, hey, we expect optimum growth at about 67 degrees Fahrenheit for cool season grasses. And so that's what this model uses. And then we also consider what's the available soil moisture, right? Because generally speaking, the amount of top growth you get will be governed by how much water is sort of moving through that plant. You need evapotranspiration and you need available water, right? So when you have clay soils that hold more water, that's why this model is generally going to have more growth in those areas versus sandy soils. But the cool thing about talking to Bill last week, he's got this, you know, nitrogen responsiveness index that he calls it. And especially with the rye grasses early in the year, we find that top growth is not correlated to sort of photosynthetic capacity. So when we say 67 degrees Fahrenheit, optimum temperature at which photosynthesis occurs, that's the production of carbohydrate, storage of energy, essentially. But then how the plant distributes that energy is governed by sort of different processes. And for ryegrass, that's more like 60 degrees is when it starts saying, hey, we're gonna use that energy on top growth. And so I think one of the reasons we've seen this model not do so great in the spring is because, especially on plots with ryegrass, we have that temperature set a little bit too high, right? So I think it's pretty good for tall fescue, like that tall fescue, because it's going to skew more towards the warmer end when it grows at an optimum rate. It's probably a good growth rate for tall fescue, but for something like ryegrass or poa, which starts coming out early in the spring, it probably is underrating the amount of growth you're going to get early season. So that's one of the interesting things that came out of our conversation with Bill.
Yeah. And I will say, Carl, I mean, if you have sandy soils and you have the ability to dry them out, that is going to be, again, another effective growth regulator in the golf world is letting them dry out. Now, of course, as you let them dry out, you have to be careful about soil breaking and isolated dry spots and things like that. So as you go for drying things out, which is something we were talking about in this conversation this time last year when we were going through the really dry weather. So again, when you're thinking about growth, you know, historically we think of a very sort of traditional growth model. This is something Al Turgeon and the late great Joe Vargas proposed many years ago. Annual bluegrass, really pretty steady growth, except through the summertime. And, you know, we're really starting to rethink a lot of things about annual bluegrass, perennial type, annual type. But one thing for sure, it grows different than creeping bentgrass. And again, I was looking at some pretty heavily regulated fairways yesterday, Carl, over at Craigburn. Terrence is not shy on his using of the ANU growth regulator. And boy, you could really see the difference in the dramatic regulation that you're getting on the annual bluegrass and not much regulation on the creeping bentgrass. So wouldn't say he's actively trying to remove the annual bluegrass, but if you are, I saw some things with the ANU yesterday, and we've seen some speculation about this from Scott McElroy and Bill Kreiser that ANU might have some potential to take out annual bluegrass like an herbicide. And I think, a lot of people have been thinking about this for a while, but I think it is something to consider as we start to try to manage annual bluegrass and maybe get rid of it. So I just want to talk a little bit about growth, right? Because we talk about growth potential. And again, just reminding people, because I've gotten so used to seeing over-regulated turf in the spring in northern climates. I just think it's good to remind everybody about this. And this is what Bill has been developing for many years at Greenkeeper, are these growing degree day models that will track the amount of regulation that you get and then when you need to reapply, knowing that the plant and the soil are processing these plant growth regulators, and you can measure their effectiveness by monitoring growth. Now, yesterday, Terrence uses 230 growing degree days for all of his PGR applications. In fact, I would say he builds his entire program around when he makes his growth regulator application, which I thought was really, really refreshing to see. And also creates an alternative to the banter we normally get, because good old Joe Lucas was there yesterday, ready to give me a hard time. And Terrence was all over the growing degree day thing. And he talked about how bad the rebound can be. And now, with not many rounds and, you know, not a lot of pressure, he's nimble to spray on a Friday morning or a Sunday morning or a Wednesday. You know what I mean? When you have the flexibility, you can really follow this thing. But I think what I want to say here is, if you look carefully at these lines, you see trim it is the most dramatic regulation, followed by ANU. And then the lightest amount of regulation at use rates is primo. So again, you can moderate these rates based the amount of regulation based on the rate of the product, but the frequency of the application continues to be what you want to pay attention to. Now, again, for those of you watching us live or watching the video of this, you'll have a really good depiction here of what over-regulation can look like when you're putting on herbicides, fungicides, growth regulators that all have growth regulating properties. You could be regulating up to 80% of your growth, which is not a problem. I mean, one of the things I saw yesterday is they were mowing fairways after 2 days of growth and you couldn't find the clipping. So, you know, I don't ever want to underestimate the value of really regulating, especially fairways where you got 25 acres, you're mowing them 3 days a week, and then you got to go out and blow them if your growth regulators aren't working right because you got clippings all over the place. This is a really important part of managing growth in the spring, especially during the surge. Now, speaking of surges, It's coming. If you haven't seen it yet, you will. You're going to find out how good your seed head suppression is in the next few weeks as the flush of growth starts to come on throughout the state of New York. Obviously, the New York metropolitan area is well into its heavy flush, and the rest of the state is about to experience it. So this is a really good time to keep track of your seed head suppression programs that, as just a reminder, get locked in the fall and then supported through the early spring. And again, every spring, we haven't talked about it much, and I think it's sort of a testament to something Ben told us last year, Carl. Annual bluegrass weevil is now moving to the secondary problem status from being a primary problem. But if you are out there looking around, you'll see the rhododendron starting to flower. This is a good time for your larvicide applications. For those of you that pay attention to the Syngenta Greencast blog that Ben puts out, you can see that the basically with a warm spell at the end of April has accelerated stage two, which means stages one and two are coming together. So you might be making a early instar and a late instar at the same time. So you want to pay attention to this application, especially if you're not making adulticide applications anymore. This larvicide is your sole chance to get control. Now, thankfully, we're not as dry as we were, so the grass is humming along pretty good. We always know annual bluegrass weevil damage tends to be worse when there's other stresses. And so hopefully we can grow through it. But I do think when we're coming at the end of seed heads, you see a natural decline in your annual bluegrass population because all those tillers that flower die. So you get normal thinning. Then you get the potential for annual bluegrass weevil problems. So you want to keep track of this. I also think these are times when if you start pushing it, especially when it's wet and soft, and you start causing some physical or mechanical damage to those putting surfaces, I am sure you're going to see anthracnose. No matter how many things you spray, if you start to cause that stress, if you're getting a little light with nitrogen because you're freaking out about green speed early, maybe you're a little overregulated, I wouldn't be surprised to see anthracnose jump its, show its unsightly head. A couple more things before I close up and we maybe take some questions. Just a reminder, we're in the midst of No Mow May, which means lawns should be flowering like crazy based on our risk assessment model. This is really what it's going to look like for a while now, right, Carl, with the clover population beginning to come. And just a healthy reminder, we say if you're going to apply anything, make sure you mow. But you also want to make sure that after you mow, those flowers are gone. And if they're not, do not apply things to that lawn. It's just not worth the risk. I mean, making an application, especially an insecticide, which we're in that window now between dandelion and clover flowering, maybe where you can get your grub control down. The first thing I tell you is kill the damn weeds first. If that's what you're going to do, get rid of the weeds. If you want a flowering lawn, don't start applying insecticides to it. That just doesn't make any sense. And of course, we've been on and on about No Mow May, but soon June 1 will come. And then this is what is awaiting everyone. And it's going to be very interesting to see. There's a number of online citizen science research projects going on that we'll be looking forward to. Now, as I wrap it up, Carl, we got this picture from our pal, Dr. Sitko, the director of golf and sports turf here at Cornell. Dollar spots underway, and our models indicating this is what's going on. And again, you have areas that are of high risk and high value. I think it's maybe a little bit earlier than I thought it was going to be, but it's also moving into the point where high value turf's probably going to need some protection from this dollar spot. So, Carl, that's what I got for today. Any questions or other things we want to cover before we get out of here?
Yeah, I don't see any questions. Maybe we'll show data next week, Frank, but it's interesting. We've talked about No Mow May for a couple of years now, and I don't see the Google Trends. You can go on this Google Trends page and look at search terms like No Mow May and see the relative sort of intensity of search terms over the years. And we're not seeing it at the same level as we have been seeing it the last 3 years. So, yeah, is that due to the Cornell Turf Show talking about the science behind No Mo May last year? I don't know if, you know, correlation is not causation, but we are seeing a trend, I think, of people being a little more strategic in how they're thinking about pollinators. They're just sort of letting grass grow and then chopping it down.
And I know, you know, as we wrap up in the golf section, Carl, just want to tell you, yesterday the bunker conversation came up again. It's very interesting when you get a group of superintendents together, the topic around lining, right? Cloth, sod, Billy Bunker, Capcon. That's a very interesting conversation. Then it's white sand, dark sand, what kind of sand? And then it's hand rake, mechanical rake, Australian method. And now, you know, particularly Craig Byrne, they're going to really go through. They got some aerials that show these very jagged tooth bunkers. Terrence kept saying Pasa Tiempo like sort of bunkers that honestly are not very Trent Jonesy, but they've got these images from 69 that show that. So just another shout out to golf course superintendents about keeping people mindful of the amount of time and energy you're spending in these hazards and how much it contributes to the overall sort of labor demands that a golf course has. Terrence is about 27 to 29 guys on an 18 hole property. And when he puts those bunkers in, he's going to need every one of them based on what I saw. So just a shout out again to everybody working on bunker stuff. It's sort of this hidden cost that we know about and everybody complains about, but I think impacts the whole operation.
Yeah. And there's data now, and Adam Engel at Lakeshore was telling us a lot of superintendents per acre bunkers take the same amount of, or cost the same amount as putting greens. And when we think about the relative importance of those two surfaces to the golf experience, right? It's not quite equal, I would say.
All right.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next Thursday for, I think, is our final scheduled turf show of the year.
Yeah, and we might do a bonus episode here or there, but we'll definitely have a guest next week. See you guys.
Take care, everybody.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.